Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside looking in. Timothy Leary lives. No, 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 he's outside.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the ineluctable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, we continue our discussion about recovery. My guest is Sheila Vicaria, policy manager at the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of Academic Engagement. Before we can really talk about addiction to drugs and drug use, we probably ought to talk about what drugs are. Drugs are not simply defined as over-the-counter or prescription or illegals. Drugs also include caffeine, nicotine, alcohol. So when we talk about recovery, it's important to remember that in reality, most people use drugs, and most people who use drugs do so in a non-problematic way. I was actually concerned that doing a show about recovery could end up further stigmatizing people who use drugs, because we are talking only about addiction and recovery from addiction and talking about drug use without making that point clear. And I asked Sheila about that.
When we talk about recovery, it's important to add nuance, right? So if we're going to talk about recovery, to talk about it in a way that doesn't perpetuate any sort of mythology or idea that there's only one way to recover, I think that that's like a responsible way for most of us to talk about recovery. So, you know, having this conversation is always a great opportunity to say that, you know, recovery should be self-defined. I mean, a lot of people in traditional treatment settings who may be influenced by more traditional substance use kind of lingo and jargon may have an idea of recovery as being completely abstinence-oriented and substance-free, particularly your substance of choice, but perhaps other substances as well. And so, you know, one way to have this conversation in a way that doesn't mythologize recovery or hold it up beyond any other possible outcome is the idea that wellness is recovery, and that people often feel well and can be well and functional in their lives with or without substances. And I think that that is helpful. And so, yeah, as long as you're creating a space for that conversation too, I don't think we're upholding it above anything else, because it is a viable outcome for a lot of people, and it can look different and feel different for different people.
Thank you. So, yeah, I also wanted to talk about harm reduction and the kind of ways in which our, you know, the stigma that we place upon drug use is basically costing lives. You're in New York. I'm out here on the West Coast in Oregon. There are cities on both coasts and across the country that are looking at supervised consumption facilities, safe consumption spaces, as a way of trying to reduce the number of deaths and try and get us out of this overdose crisis that we've gotten ourselves into. How are things looking in that?
Yeah, I mean, they are becoming a part of our national discourse in a way that many of us could never have even imagined, given that the climate in the U.S. is so different than, you know, among folks in other countries, which have already been able to move forward with opening their own supervised consumption spaces. So first and foremost, it's really exciting to see headlines and to even hear that people are having conversations about these spaces. And what we're hearing also is that, you know, these conversations are popping up in cities across the country that we might not have even thought of as wanting to be part of these harm reduction conversations. You know, sometimes we are guilty of having these kind of coastal conversations, but also coastal conversations that mostly focus on New York and California. But, you know, Seattle was kind of at the beginning of some of this. You know, Ithaca, you know, in upstate New York small town was also kind of having that conversation. Philadelphia having this conversation. And so I think that it's a really exciting time that people are willing to talk about this. But unfortunately, these conversations are largely informed by the devastation that we are currently facing. I mean, recent data shows us that 72,000 people were estimated to have died of overdoses last year. So also these conversations that are almost centering harm reduction or the possibility of a harm reduction intervention really were only even introduced into the conversation as a result of tremendous, tremendous loss and deaths that perhaps could have been prevented, that we could have been intervening sooner with, right? So it's kind of like this double-edged sword. And what I have to say is that I am trying to be hopeful in that I do believe that, you know, within the next year, we will see a facility, if not multiple facilities, open. However, we are also at a tenuous time where it's just a matter of who's going to start. Because I think that as soon as the first ones start, we will see that kind of that ripple effect. And the longer that we wait and the more time this takes, the more people are dying and the clock is ticking. Fentanyl is out there. People are in unsafe conditions. You know, naloxone access, although we've been doing really great, naloxone isn't in the hands and it isn't always accessible to people who need it. And honestly, you know, when we think about access to medication-assisted treatment, again, you know, we have more wavered data, 2000 wavered physicians and providers than we've had historically. However, we still know that there's huge barriers to buprenorphine access. And, you know, when will we start, you know, I have this fantasy of methadone mobile vans. When will we ever even see those as a possibility in a country like this? How many more people have to die before we're willing to have those conversations? So it's, you know, it's a bittersweet time. It's a bittersweet time, but I think it's really important to try to maintain hope that things will move forward.
Do you think there is some overlap between harm reduction and recovery?
Absolutely. I mean, I find that one of the biggest myths about harm reduction is that we are somehow anti-abstinence and anti-recovery. And I would argue that harm reduction is part of a larger continuum of care for people who use substances and who engage in perhaps high-risk practices, and that no way are they mutually exclusive. I think they're part of the same continuum. I think that people in recovery are practicing harm reduction in the sense that they have either eliminated the use of their substance of choice as a way to reduce harm in their lives, or they've found other ways to manage their substance or use other substances that, again, can help reduce the harms in their lives. So I never saw, you know, harm reduction and recovery as mutually exclusive. And there are so many amazing harm reduction activists, you know, leaders, peers, providers, organizers who self-identify as being in recovery, and however they may define it, many of them through 12-step facilitation and 12-step group membership, many of them in their own way and on their own terms. And so I absolutely think that, you know, there is a natural alliance to me between harm reduction and recovery, because our goal is life, health, and safety and people's humanity and giving people another chance. So I think that there is more of a connection there than you know, some people would see. But those of us who live harm reduction, who breathe harm reduction, who think harm reduction, recovery is part of that conversation.
I'm going to go back to stigma for a moment, because this is this again is a thing where I think where we have people who are, you know, calling for decriminalization, legalization. And that's a harm reduction thing too, of course, decriminalizing. That has something to do with recovery too, as it goes back to stigma. I mean, if you're telling someone that they are a criminal, then that's, you know, or telling them that in order to get help, they have to raise their hand and say, "Hi, I'm a criminal. I break the law on a regular basis." That's got to discourage people from trying to seek help.
Yeah, I mean, criminalization has a really interesting relationship with recovery and harm reduction and treatment in two ways, because more than ever, our criminal justice system has become one of the largest so-called, you know, treatment and housing providers for people who have substance use disorders in the country, in the sense that, you know, the criminal justice system is a place where a lot of people who use illicit drugs, problematically or otherwise, end up having contact with. And so our jails or our prisons are full of people who use drugs, and that is the travesty. But then we also know that the criminal justice system is one of the hugest referral sources for substance use treatment in the United States. You know, even when we move towards our alternatives to incarceration, or we move towards, you know, expanding the drug court model, or, you know, making, you know, completion of treatment a condition of successful parole or probation terms, we have enmeshed the criminal justice system and the criminalizing of substance use with treatment and recovery in a way that's really, really complicated, and it's really, really contaminated and really impacted the ways in which we provide treatment as well. I'm a former treatment provider. I worked at an outpatient treatment program for some time, and our largest referral source were parole and probation officers, because so many people got locked up because of their substance use or their addiction, and then it was condition of their release and completion of their treatment that helped them, you know, successfully participate through probation. And, you know, that was the hammer hanging over their heads. So, you know, they were in treatment, we were supposed to be therapeutic, yet I was also supposed to call and check in with POs all the time to let them know how my clients were doing, whether they had any positive drug screens. And, you know, if they were non-compliant, then the PO would say, well, maybe treatment isn't for them. Maybe we need to lock them up for a little bit. Maybe we need to send them back. I worked with people who were in drug court, again, and, you know, me going before the judge and me having to report back on how my clients were doing, and also knowing that being too honest might mean that the judge would sanction the person to a night in jail, or create some other punitive kind of consequence. So it's really interesting the ways in the criminal justice system has really entrenched itself with treatment and recovery. And a lot of people think that if not for the criminal justice system mandating treatment, that people wouldn't be in treatment, so it's actually life-saving, rather than interpreting the fact that the criminal justice system has to be our biggest referral source, as perhaps maybe there's something wrong with the way that we're doing treatment and that we're not really attracting people who want to be there for help, but people who end up getting shoved there and forced there with really harsh consequences hanging over their heads.
You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. There's an interview with Sheila Vakharia, PhD. She's a policy manager at the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of Academic Engagement. We're discussing recovery and stigma and criminalization. The Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration defines recovery from mental disorders and/or substance use disorders as, quote, a process of change through which individuals improve their health and wellness, live a self-directed life, and strive to reach their full potential, end quote. SAMHSA has come up with four major dimensions that support a life in recovery, and that's health, home, purpose, and community. They've also laid out some guiding principles of recovery. First, recovery emerges from hope. The belief that recovery is real provides the essential and motivating message of a better future, that people can and do overcome the internal and external challenges, barriers, and obstacles that confront them. Recovery is person-driven. Self-determination and self-direction are the foundations for recovery as individuals define their own life goals and design their own unique paths toward those goals. Recovery occurs via many pathways. Individuals are unique with distinct needs, strengths, preferences, goals, cultures, and backgrounds, including trauma experiences that affect and determine their pathways to recovery. Recovery is holistic. Recovery encompasses an individual's whole life, including mind, body, spirit, and community. This includes addressing self-care practices, family, housing, employment, education, clinical treatment for mental disorders and substance use disorders, services and supports, primary health care, dental care, complementary and alternative services, faith, spirituality, creativity, social networks, transportation, and community participation. Recovery is supported by peers and allies. Mutual support and mutual aid groups, including the sharing of experiential knowledge and skills, as well as social learning, play an invaluable role in recovery. Recovery is supported through relationship and social networks. An important factor in the recovery process is the presence and involvement of people who believe in the person's ability to recover, who offer hope, support, and encouragement, and who also suggest strategies and resources for change. Recovery is culturally based and influenced. Culture and cultural background, in all of its diverse representations, including values, traditions, and beliefs, are keys in determining a person's journey and a unique pathway to recovery. Recovery is supported by addressing trauma. The experience of trauma, such as physical or sexual abuse, domestic violence, war, disaster, and others, is often a precursor to or associated with alcohol and other drug use, mental health problems, and related issues. Recovery involves individual, family, and community strengths and responsibility. Individuals should be supported in speaking for themselves. Families and significant others have responsibilities to support their loved ones, especially for children and youth in recovery. Communities have responsibilities to provide opportunities and resources to address discrimination and to foster social inclusion and recovery. Individuals in recovery also have a social responsibility and should have the ability to join with peers to speak collectively about their strengths, needs, wants, desires, and aspirations. And finally, recovery is based on respect. Community, systems, and societal acceptance and appreciation for people affected by mental health and substance use problems, including protecting our rights and eliminating discrimination, are crucial in achieving recovery. There is a need to acknowledge that taking steps toward recovery may require great courage. Self-acceptance, developing a positive and meaningful sense of identity, and regaining belief in oneself are particularly important. Again, that's the working definition of recovery from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that SAMHSA also provides a national helpline for free, confidential, 24/7, 365 treatment referral and information services in both Spanish and English for individuals and families who are facing mental and/or substance use disorders. That national helpline is 1-800-662-4357. That's 800-662-4357. You can also go to the SAMHSA website at samhsa.gov. And now let's get back to my interview with Sheila Vakaria, PhD, Policy Manager at the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of Academic Engagement, and our discussion about recovery, stigma, and criminalization. Tell me about some of the work that that you're doing at DPA. What other things are on your radar?
Well, so my role at DPA is kind of an interesting one. So I don't have any sort of policy advocacy capacity in my role. My role here is predominantly as a researcher. So I am a resource to the other staff and my colleagues, doing the policy advocacy work, doing the communications work to help better inform our stance with research and evidence, so that we're pushing forward policies that we think will work and will have an impact, given what we do know about drug use and drug policy. So, some of the things that are really on our radar that I've been working very closely on are, having conversations about what, as an organization, we support drug decriminalization, which we do, and we are really trying, we launched a report last summer about all drug decrim and the need for it, and, we aren't the first people to talk about all drug decrim. Human Rights Watch has also talked about the need for all drug decrim and other organizations as well. So, one of the things that my office is involved with is, having conversations about what would decriminalization look like? What would we like for it to look like? Another important part of my work is helping to respond to some of the conversations that have been emerging around fentanyl and fentanyl adulteration and the expansive use of drug-induced homicide prosecutions as a way to, that our administration thinks will squelch the involvement of fentanyl in our drug supply, so challenging, finding research and data to kind of challenge the use of drug-induced homicides and really, dispelling myths about fentanyl and what it does and ways in which to really address fentanyl adulteration in our drug supply. Another big part of the work that I do with my research is I'm really interested in, the outcomes of marijuana legalization and medicalization across the country, really keeping a close eye on youth rates, because I know that that's an area that a lot of people are concerned about. If we medicalize marijuana, we legalize it for adult use, what does that say to the kids are young people using at higher rates? So I very much have my finger on the pulse of all the new research that comes out about young people and marijuana. But I'm also really also interested in marijuana and opioid-related harms and prescription and heroin. And so I've also really been paying a lot of attention about state-level policies and opioid-related harms and overdose-related harms, because I think there's some really interesting research coming out about the potential role that medical marijuana, but also recreational adult use marijuana, can have in, you know, substituting for opioids for some people. So, yeah, those are kind of some of the issue areas that I've been thinking about, reading about, medication-assisted treatment, buprenorphine access. Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned, I'm actually curious about, this is utterly off the regular topic, but it's a concern. These homicide laws providing to, you know, kill the dealers. It struck me that what we're more likely to see, rather than someone who's actually, you know, heavily involved in the commerce, more likely to see somebody who basically picked up two bags, gave the friend one, and they did the other one. And so the person, I mean, it's just targeting, it's low hanging fruit, just targeting more users. Is that just my attitude, or is that something that actually is being borne out?
Yeah, that's what the evidence is showing. I mean, we, Drug Policy Alliance, we released a report on drug-induced homicide called An Overdose Death Is Not a Murder in December. And one of the biggest things that we found in that review that led to the writing of the report was that largely, first of all, if low-level so-called sellers are targeted, they're often people who were framed as sellers for copping for themselves and a friend and maybe taking a couple bucks on top, or that they are low-level sellers who themselves were only selling just to support their own habits. And so, yeah, absolutely. We're finding that these laws target people at the bottom, the absolute bottom of the supply-side totem pole, who probably had no idea that their supply was contaminated or had no way of testing or ensuring how much was contaminated, because most of us are thinking that when fentanyl does enter our drug supplies, it's entered high enough in the supply chain, perhaps even before it even came into the country, that we really can't hold low-level suppliers or dealers responsible. And oftentimes, they are not motivated to kill their own customers. And so even these counterintuitive laws of, you know, getting potentially prosecuted for murder paints these big, bad drug dealers, when we know that social suppliers, people who supply their friends, people who just made a little bit of money on top, but may actually even have their own 9-to-5 jobs that they're just supplementing their income with selling, are being targeted. And, you know, friends and co-users who may have shot up from the same bag but had a completely different reaction. And I woke up and you didn't. And that was enough to say that perhaps I had something to do, you know, that you had something to, you know, I had something to do with yours. So that's what the research is telling us, is that, you know, based on preliminary kind of analyses of these prosecutions, they're not really even targeting dealers. And that's not the way to get fentanyl out of our drug supply. If anything, it's just vengeful. It's another, you know, it's another way of being overly punitive, and it's not going to save lives.
It strikes me that things like those so-called, you know, sell drugs death thing, it's just asking more people to die of overdose. That's more of, I mean, goes back to stigma.
Yeah, and it also really goes in the face of what we actually want people to do. It counteracts all the positives that we were hoping to see from the passing of Good Samaritan laws. You know, we wanted to reduce barriers to calling 911, hence so many states across the country have passed Good Samaritan laws that, you know, depending on the circumstances of what happened and perhaps whether or not you have an active criminal charge or if you're involved in the criminal justice system, which is another thing we can talk about, but, you know, that could protect people from some sort of reasonable liability or being charged with paraphernalia if they call 911 in good faith because someone is obviously in a medical emergency. And, you know, so we passed these laws. We hoped it would increase the calls to 911. We hoped that people would reach out and get help and that help would arrive and that people wouldn't end up dying. And then here we have these drug-induced homicide prosecutions, which fly in the face of that. So, you know, now in addition to, you know, having fears about being charged as a murderer, we've just created another reason for people to not call 911. And this is also because one of the things that happens in the United States is you call 911, and oftentimes the first people to show up are police officers long before the EMTs make it there. And so, again, even just the way that our criminal justice system has hijacked healthcare, in another example, as I said earlier, with, you know, just traditional treatment being hijacked, you know, those of us providers having to report back to POs and courts about how well our clients are doing. Here we have people calling for help in a real medical emergency, and if the first responders don't make it in time, the police are there to say, this is the scene of a crime. This is the scene of a murder. Look at all this paraphernalia. Hey, do you have a charge? Are you on probation right now? Because perhaps this Good Sam law doesn't apply to you anyway.
That was my interview with Sheila Vicaria, Ph.D. She's with the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of Academic Engagement. We were talking about stigma, criminalization, and recovery. And that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I want to thank my guest, Sheila Vicaria. A big thank you to our engineer. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio has a webpage at kboo.fm/freeculture, where you can find a complete archive of past shows. Free Culture Radio also has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/kboofreecultureradio. Please give it a like. You'll find links there to past shows, announcements about upcoming programs and events, and other stuff like news items that may be of interest. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!